Welcome to the Spoolcast. Kim Goodwin joins Jared Spool in a discussion about scenarios. Kim will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 18 Conference, October 21st through 23rd in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Well, hello there. Glad you're joining us today. I have with me the fabulous Kim Goodwin, who we've talked to about, I think, exactly 145 times before. But she always has fabulous things to say. And Kim is doing a workshop at the User Interface 18 conference, which is going to be in Boston on October 21st through 23rd. And she's giving a full-day workshop called Using Scenarios to Design Intuitive Experiences. She's given this workshop for us before. It's always amongst the best rated workshops of the event, and we're very happy she's coming back. And she's joining us from beautiful California today. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Jared. How are you?
I am doing fabulous. It's great to have you here. So I thought we could talk about some stuff that when we were planning your workshop for this year, there were things that you brought up, and it was really fascinating to me. And one of them, you just made this offhand comment that people are going to learn how just asking a product manager for requirements is an ineffective way to figure out what to build in the release. And yet so many people do it this way, right? The first thing you do is your stakeholder meetings, and you gather your requirements and you put them into a requirements document, which some people actually have given the official initials of PRD for product requirements document. And it's this whole ritual that every project starts with. And if you don't have your PRD, no wonder you're going to fail. But tell me, is the PRD the pamphlet of doom?
Well, sometimes it's the pamphlet of doom. Sometimes it's the, you know, phone book of doom because they're huge.
That's true. Yeah. Some of these, I've seen some of these things. They make a solid thump when you hit the table with them.
It's true. Yeah. I hear a lot of designers saying, oh gosh, the requirements are hard to work with, or they're not very good, or we're still waiting for requirements. To which my response is, why the heck are you waiting for someone to hand you requirements instead of driving them yourself? Now, that's not to say that UX owns the requirements. I don't think that we do. And it's not to say that we have exclusive insight into all of them, because certainly on any project, there are requirements that are not really about the users, you know, things like regulations we have to comply with, or things we have to do to be viable in the marketplace, especially if we're selling to businesses and not to consumers or direct to users. But I think that the assumption that we can know all the requirements before we start to actually imagine what the user experience is like is a little crazy to me, right? You know, I see a lot of requirements that say, you know, the list box has to contain these 17 things. And really? Is there a list box? What screen is this even on? I don't know that yet. How do you know that?
Yeah, but isn't some of this to counter the problem that we had before we did these excessive PRD phone books, which was that you'd be three quarters of the way through the project and discover some major requirement that nobody had ever told you, and now you have to go back and redesign, but you can't go back and redesign because development has already started coding some of it. And, you know, part of it was to get rid of that churn.
Sure. But I think that churn happens anyway. You know, I've never seen one of these things done up front in great detail that wasn't half thrown out by the time you actually even did the first design sketches. So I think that that's a very waterfall-y way to do things. And there are some benefits to waterfall, you know.
You get water.
There's that. But I think there's a certain parallel process that takes place. While you have people looking at the businessy side of the requirements and the technical issues we have to handle, that can happen in parallel with our early user research and with our early sketches and scenarios. And we can say, okay, from a user's point of view, here's what this thing has to deliver to be really awesome. Here's what this experience needs to be to really delight and engage users and to accomplish the work they need to do. And that should inform what the ultimate requirements are. Now, I think in a healthy process, the UX team is essentially proposing requirements, right? We're saying, here's what we think it would take to be delightful and desirable as a solution. And the engineers are saying, here's what we think it would take to make that. And then the product manager is saying, how much of that design goodness can I actually make money building? Right. So we're always ideally going to propose a bit more than really gets built. That's normal and healthy. So I don't think we're the ones making the trade-offs, but using our tools and our particular insights, I think we can really drive that process to be a lot faster and actually a lot more concrete, because a requirement expressed in a sketch is a whole lot more clear to the engineering team than, you know, item 13.2.12, you know, must do, blah, blah, blah.
So these sketches, do you have a sense as to how we catalog and keep them? I mean, do we assemble them into the phone book? Or what tricks have you used for dealing with large numbers of sketches that are, in essence, the replacement for these lengthy requirement docs?
You know, I really think it depends on the team and the environment. A lot of people will tell you, oh, this is the way you should do deliverables. And I have to disagree with that, because I think that may be the way you do deliverables in that company. But if you have a small, very nimble team of super skilled developers who all sit next to you, you can be very informal with this stuff. And if you have a huge, globally distributed team of not so skilled developers and a giant legacy product, you need to get a lot more formal about that management. So, you know, to my mind, the way that we manage that is mostly about how is this engineering team used to working? And that's fine. You feed it into the processes that are effective for them, but, you know, you don't necessarily let that legacy process drive how we ideate.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, because I'm thinking about, because there are some of these organizations, everything has to go through this workflow process of getting signed off and, you know, people reviewing and all that stuff. And if you can get everybody in one room and they can sort of sign off at the same time and say, yeah, this is great, this is exactly what we want, then that's a very different thing than if I have to send this document over to legal to review, and then we have to send it over to compliance, and then we have to send it over to the, you know, product managers, and then marketing has their say, and of course the CEO is going to come in and tell you that it should work the way the thing his wife likes.
And yeah, absolutely. And you just said something that I think is very key, Jared, which is getting everybody in the room at the same time, whether that's a virtual room or a real one. I think if you have early sketches, the minute you feel like you've got a concept that's hanging together, you want to get all those important constituents in the room at the same time, just for a sketch review. I had one with a team just the other day. You know, the marketing team has to launch the thing, and the engineers have to figure out how to build it, and the product manager has to figure out, you know, does it fit in the budget? And so, you know, we just pulled all those constituents together in the same room and said, here's what we're thinking, here's where we're headed. You know, a couple of people contributed good ideas that improved the design. A couple of people had questions about, how are we going to do this? You know, and I think that we came to everybody headed in the right direction. And now from there, everybody knows exactly what they need to do to get this thing out the door.
Cool. So I got another question for you that came up when we were talking. Everybody is talking about these journey map things, right? So, you know, when I imagine journey maps, most of the time the ones I see are this timeline that shows the experience of a particular user. Sometimes we aggregate users across them. But the idea is that they show a continuous journey of the person sort of finding out about your service and then coming to your service and trying it the first time. Or maybe it's the journey of what it's like to create a new account, or maybe it's the journey of producing some end of year report or whatever the activity is. And it's usually on a scale that measures some sort of delight to frustration, so that you can quickly just visualize these things. And they started popping up a couple of years ago, and now everybody's talking about that. Are you seeing that?
Absolutely. I've been using journey maps a ton myself, and I think they have a lot of different uses. And I think they're great teaching tools, they're great team collaboration tools, they're great synthesis tools from your research. We can talk about any of those aspects if you want to, but I think they have at least three or four great uses.
Well, I'm curious how they play into the work you've been doing with scenarios.
I think what's helpful about journey maps in scenarios is a couple things. Well, if you think about the journey map as the expression of what's happening today, right? It's a document of some sort, you know, a diagram, a sketch, a table, whatever you want to do, that says, here's what people are going through today. Here's how they feel about what they're going through. Here's what's driving them crazy about what they're going through. Here are all the tools they're using, the people they're talking to, the decisions they're making along the way. It really helps you understand, oh, what people are going through is much more complex than this one web page that I think is my job to design today. So it helps to break down that siloed perspective, which is one of the things that scenarios are also great for, is people do not experience features. People do not experience the thing that your team builds as separate from their encounter with the rest of the organization, right? They see it all as one piece, and they expect to feel known across that whole journey. They expect to have information passed from one part of that journey to the other. They want it to be seamless. And so journey maps help you see where that isn't happening today. And I found, as I've been teaching people to build scenarios over the years, that it used to be people would get kind of stuck at the invention stage of the scenario. If the scenario is the story of what the future of this experience will be, they'd kind of scratch their heads and say, I don't know, what do I do? Whereas a journey map gives you a starting point, because if you say, all right, I'm going to clean up this part and I'm going to improve these stages, what would a better version of that look like? It's a perfect starting point for envisioning the future.
So where do you typically get the stuff that you put on your journey map? Is this just sort of guesswork amongst the team, or is it, are you going out and meeting with real users and documenting what's really happening? Or,
well, you could start with guesswork, but it's certainly not as effective as going out into the field and talking with real users. I think that ethnography is my favorite tool by far for this stuff. You can't really get the kind of depth and detail with a survey or a focus group. But if you actually go out and watch somebody experience this and talk to them as they're experiencing it, or if it's a long, involved journey, you sort of have to do that retrospectively. But asking people for stories about their experience gets you pretty good specificity, and a story is also fairly accurate as opposed to generalizations. You get a little bit less self-reporting error that way. And then you aggregate basically journeys across people. Now, if you have multiple personas, you might need to do multiple journey maps, because often those journeys are a little bit different.
How are they different?
Well, it depends on the personas, right? Sometimes two personas will have a very similar journey, but will have different attitudes or experience levels that they bring to the journey. In other cases, the journey is quite different because maybe they approach the problem with a different mental model, or they're, in the case of a business application, they're working in a different environment with different processes, or if you have the case of people performing a task, they just have a different habit or a different sequence they do things in.
Right. So if I'm uploading photos from my vacation, one persona might sort of upload a photo and share it, and then pick out another one from their collection, upload it in photo, whereas somebody else might batch upload every photo and then go through and tweak them once they're uploaded. And you could talk about the journeys of each of those.
Right, right. And, you know, you could do a journey map after every single user interview. That's very tedious and time consuming. I don't actually do that. However, I do find that for people who are new to doing ethnographies, a journey map after their first few user interviews is a great teaching tool, because if they try to fill out a journey map and realize, oh, I only got half that information, they will do a much better interview the next time. So I use them as interview teaching tools as well.
Oh, that's interesting. It's basically a way to validate that you collected all the right stuff.
Exactly.
That's a really neat use of it. Is a journey map a document you keep referring to over and over and over again, or is it mostly one of these documents that you do it and you look at it for a bit and you go, aha, okay, that's what I've learned from it, and then you tend to put it away and you don't go back to that particular document again?
Yeah, I would say it's a step along the way, not really a living document, because the journey map is documenting the present. And we don't really need to dwell on the present for very long. We just need to look at the present long enough to figure out what's wrong with it, what can we fix, what could we be much more delightful about. And then once you have essentially replaced the journey map of today with the wonderful, beautiful scenario of the future, you don't really need the journey map so much anymore.
Cool. Have you found that there's a way to map the future versus the current so you can see the delta? Have you ever done that?
You know, sometimes I think people find it useful to essentially use the journey map as a starting point for a scenario. So, you know, if you have a few rows in your journey map, you know, one that articulates what people do, another that shows how they feel about it, you could add another row at the bottom that's basically, and how are we going to unsuck this? And then people just start filling that in and kind of brainstorming around it. I think that that's a useful tool for people who aren't really used to working with scenarios. But I don't usually spend time doing the delta so much, because if the team has worked with you along the way, they know the delta. I guess the point of doing that more formally would be if you're doing work for the team, which is generally not as successful anyway. So that's why I don't really do it.
Right. I mean, say a little bit more about this, you know, working for the team thing.
Well, you know, Jared, that I've spent a lot of years as a consultant, right? And early in my consulting career, I thought, all right, well, if the clients just leave us alone to do our thing, that's so much easier and everyone's happier. And I think a lot of people start their careers that way. And, you know, I'm certainly not the only one to have observed that the closer the team is to you and the more involved they are, the more they believe it. And the more they're able to extend your thinking, because it's their thinking. Right? And they own the solution and they help make the solution better. So journey mapping is a thing that you can do with a team. If you have a bunch of people who've all gone out and done interviews, you know, if you've interviewed similar enough people, you can do some aggregate journey mapping together. And then you can all see, oh, that's where the experience needs fixing. And oh, this stage is pretty good. And it becomes obvious to everybody at once what you need to do.
I think that's a really key point. We're often drawn, you go out on research, I've found, you go on a research and you're drawn to all the things that were really sucky. You know, oh my God, I can't believe they do it that way. I can't believe we've made it so painful for them. But what we then don't do is we don't make a good record of all the things that we actually did well, that the application is working smoothly and it's pleasant and delightful in cases. And we risk getting into trouble because we've not recorded that, so we might actually change it and break something that works really well today. And so it would feel to me like journey maps are a way to sort of capture, hey, this is working, don't break it.
Absolutely. I think the other important thing about what you just said, Jared, is that if we as UX teams only focus on the stuff that's screwed up and never acknowledge the things that are working well, boy, do we become the negative Nancys on the team, and nobody wants to hang out with us, right?
I have never used the phrase negative Nancy. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, you're the ones who, you know, who break everything. We should be taking those parts of the journey and finding the responsible party and putting them on a little pedestal and worshiping them for a little bit for doing so awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that brings me to this question I have, because you also mentioned that scenarios help you go down the road to build innovative solutions. And I'm curious, where do the scenarios come in? If we're trying to do something innovative, where do scenarios play into that?
Yeah, I would say there's two answers to that, depending on how new the thing you're trying to do is. I think innovation can happen on a small level. You know, you might be looking at a journey that's otherwise not a big revolution from where you were, but there might be one part of it where you think, oh, I could do this so categorically better. And that itself is an innovation. So, you know, you can build on that journey map to envision bits and pieces of an innovative future. If that journey today is, say, something that happens in a very analog or disconnected way, then what you do with a scenario is you say, okay, let's assume that the constraints of today don't apply. And the fact that these systems or these companies or whatever don't talk to each other, what would happen in the future if that actually weren't true? And so scenarios are essentially using storytelling, which is a tool we're all very accustomed to using to create, to unlock our imaginations and say, what if? And that's really where scenarios start. You know, we started our conversation, Jared, about with requirements and these great big PRDs. And I don't know about you, I can't imagine anything more creativity killing than a requirements document, because they're very analytical. You know, the thought of writing out 20 or 200 pages of, you know, system shall do this, system may do this, whatever. That is so not creative. That's very reductionist. It's very analytical. And that's actually the opposite of generative, which is what we need to be in the early phases of a product. What could we do?
Yeah, that generative phase is something that I think a lot of teams that I've seen don't spend enough time doing, in my experience. That someone comes up with a solution, everybody just rallies around the solution, they just start refining it, and they don't go down the road to ask the question, well, what other ways could we do it? And they may come back to that solution as the best one. It may be, in fact, the ideal way to do it, though I would think that by just exploring other ways, you see the problem from different angles, and there's probably some hybrid that you end up with.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes, hey, we came up with a pretty good idea, let's just refine it. Sometimes that's fine because you have some tight deadline or it's a thing that's not really worth investing that much time in, and that's okay. But, you know, if you're really trying to reinvent the business or you're trying to make something that's categorically better than what you've done before, you definitely need to build in some of that exploration time to say, what are multiple ways we could do this? Now, this is where, you know, scenarios alone are not your solution. You need to combine scenarios with, say, brainstorming. So a scenario helps you figure out what's the general flow of what needs to happen, what questions do we need to answer for users along the way, what work are we going to take out of the system for users. What they don't necessarily tell you is what that looks like or how exactly that happens, because a scenario is solution agnostic in a way, right? It doesn't specify the mechanism by which you accomplish things. So a scenario, in a sense, defines the design problem very clearly, and then you want to sketch a few different approaches to how could we accomplish this thing that's happening in a scenario. So for example, in a scenario, I might say that your photos that you just took, using your photo example from earlier, you just took a bunch of vacation photos and ta-da, they're on your computer now. Now, that could happen in any number of ways, some of which are easier, some of which are more expensive to build, some of which may be very competitive with what other people offer. And so that's where you say, all right, how could we do that? Well, we could have you plug a cable into the camera. We could plug your card into the card reader that's built into the computer. We could do that wirelessly and build that into the camera. You know, there's a few different ways we could do that. And that's where we engage in dialogue with our engineering and product management peers to say, we can envision a lot of ways to do this. Which one should we do based on those trade-offs of desirability, viability, feasibility?
Makes perfect sense to me. Wow. This stuff is always so interesting. I love talking to you about this.
Oh, it's always fun to talk about this stuff with you.
Yeah. So everybody, if you thought this was awesome, then you really need to sign up for Kim's full-day workshop at UI18. It's going to be on Monday, October 21st. It's called Using Scenarios to Design Intuitive Experiences. She's going to go into all of this in great detail. Everybody who took it last year just thought this was a rocking session, and people have been telling me that they've been applying it ever since. So this is really something you want to go to. Kim, thank you so much for sharing your brilliance with us just yet one more time.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks for chatting with me and brightening my morning.
And I want to thank our audience for taking the time and listening. And I hope you go off and create awesome designs. We hope to see you at User Interface 18 or one of our other events. And if you have a moment and you want to leave a review for this podcast on the iTunes, that would be awesome. We love to see those and we read them. And it's really quite great. And we'll talk to you later. Thank you very much for encouraging our behavior. Talk to you soon. Take care.
For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always, thank you for listening.